This is Mental, the podcast that destigmatizes mental health. I'm Bobby Timms.
I'm Annie Harris.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about the power of speaking up about mental health. To start off with, I've got some stats from Time to Change, who are a campaign about breaking down stigma run by Mind and Rethink Mental Illness. The stats themselves are all from the work they've done in terms of reducing stigma. Every so often they do studies to see how this is actually taking place and how successful it is. So Time to Change found public attitudes have improved by over 6% over the last 3 years, which equates to more than 2.5 million people in the UK having improved attitudes towards people with mental health problems. They also found the number of people acknowledging that they know someone close who has a mental illness increased from 58% in 2009 to 65% in 2014. They believe this may be the result of decreasing stigma and greater levels of openness about mental health problems amongst the population. Annie, thoughts on those so far?
So, classic me, I've just Googled UK cities by population. Birmingham, funnily enough, West Midlands, just under 1.5 million people. But then the next one is 8 million people, and that's London. So we don't have a city this week, unfortunately. I'm so sorry.
However, will you comprehend the stats?
This is how I interpret the stats. I'm just so thrilled. Time to Change do such amazing work. Mm-hmm. I'll never, ever stop adoring Time to Change. You know, they are absolutely wonderful. The stuff that they're doing is so incredible. I love hearing about this stuff. I love meeting up with them and hanging out with them. They're absolute babes. And I'm not surprised, you know. They're doing incredible work. They're in incredible outreach work as well. They're Time to Change champions as well. So they're also employing volunteers and young people from the community to spread the word and help break down stigma. Mm-hmm. I love them. I can't say enough good things about them. 10 out of 10 campaign.
Good. And we are both Time to Change champions as well. We do
campaign
have... Unofficially, campaign girls, we do have an episode with someone from Time to Change coming up where we'll be able to tell you even more about what that means.
Yay!
In the meantime, though, I totally agree with you, Annie, that it's so incredible the number of people they've reached so far. And particularly with that second statistic of the number of people acknowledging that they know someone close who has a mental illness, I think that's a really good benchmark for them to use in terms of reducing stigma, because I find it difficult to believe that there's anybody that doesn't know somebody with a mental illness.
Yeah.
And it may be partly that because of the stigma, they could know six people, half a dozen with mental illnesses, but they don't know because the person doesn't feel comfortable disclosing that.
Absolutely.
Or it's not something we talk enough about in our society. And so the fact that they've increased, they've seen this increase in the percentage of people that do acknowledge someone close having a mental illness, I think is really positive to see that increase. But I think realistically, it's got to be 100% for the stigma to really be gone.
Absolutely. I agree. I couldn't agree more. I think it's often harder. I think particularly from the experience that I've got with admitting that somebody that you know and love has got a mental illness. Like my family, I think still to this day, are still shocked every time I tell them I'm having therapy or I'm taking medication or, you know, my mum either has a terrible memory or just really doesn't like to admit it. But sometimes she'll be like, oh, you're having therapy. I didn't know. And I'm like, well, what do you think? You know, like it's just becoming more and more apparent that like, mental health or poor mental health, sorry, is just as common as a cough or a cold or a headache, and they should be treated in the same way. You know, it's just as common, and they are absolutely in the same way that a cough or a cold or a headache isn't our fault. Mental health isn't our fault. It's not something we've done wrong. It's not because we're bad or weak people. It's just something that happens to people. And it's really heartening, like you said, to see this increase, particularly over such a short period of time as well. Did you say over 3 years it's been a quite considerable increase in people acknowledging?
That was in 5 years.
5 years. Well, still, that's a very, you know, comparatively a very short amount of time. Mm-hmm. And particularly as these sorts of projects aren't short-term, you know, overnight fixes. They're long-term goals, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And there is a long way to go. There was one more stat I think we can bring in there, which is less positive. So that is that, again, from Time to Change, they found, although 40% of people said they would be comfortable talking to their employer about their mental health problems, which admittedly is actually more than I thought. But I guess it partly depends on the situation and why they may need to have that conversation with their employer. But they found that 48% said they would feel uncomfortable. So there's only a thin margin really there of, what, 12% of people that feel not one way or the other about it. So that is sad that more people feel uncomfortable than comfortable having that kind of a conversation.
Yeah, well, that's why I really love petitions like Natasha Devon's and Ben West's, you know, like they're making sure that there's more mental health first aid in the workplace and in education environments. So I'm just super proud to be, you know, on that radar of excellent campaigners like Time to Change. Mm-hmm. And I just couldn't be more thrilled at the work that we're doing and that they're doing.
Yeah, brilliant. I concur. So in a moment, we'll get into the interview with this week's guest, Lily, who runs an organisation called Real Talk, where she encourages others to be open in speaking about their experiences of mental health and mental illness, and in doing so provides workshops around storytelling so people can feel as comfortable and prepared as possible to share their stories and reap the benefits of being more open and feeling more comfortable sharing their experiences. Yeah, so she's really cool. I certainly myself love to be a part of the program that she runs, and hopefully we'll be able to sort something out now we are friends. But yeah, so it's a really interesting interview. I've really enjoyed speaking to her. We'll get into that interview in a moment, but first, this week's Audible recommendation. I'm recommending Reasons to Stay Alive by Matt Haig. This is a book that's currently on my reading list. I've not read it yet, but it's been recommended to me by a few of our guests. And it's Matt's true story of how he came through crisis, triumphed over his mental illness, and learned to live a happy life again. I'm told it's really moving and funny. And hopefully it's just a book that you can read and just feel a bit enriched and renewed by life through. He's really active on social media in terms of mental health awareness. He's a great campaigner, so I'm really looking forward to reading this. If it's something you'd like to try, you can read it in physical book or listen to it as an audiobook for free if it's your first one with Audible. You just need to follow our link, bit.ly/mentalbooks. The details are in the description.
Where did my journey begin? I think, like many people, that can sometimes be a difficult question to answer because it's sort of that slow and steady or maybe more insidious thing where, I don't know, it starts to slowly reveal itself and you can't really think back to a specific moment or instance where things just suddenly revealed themselves. But I definitely know that when I got into middle school, so when I was kind of turning into an adolescent, you enter middle school in the United States at about 11 years old.
So was there anything in particular that happened like in middle school that you wanted to talk about?
Well, because I guess for me, things maybe were brought forward in a more clinical way because my parents got divorced. And in the US, if you can't necessarily agree on how that's going to unfold, you might go to a judge, it might go to court, which is what happened with my parents' case. And so it was actually a judge there who said, you have a 13-year-old daughter, that's the age I was at the time, and sort of said, hey, maybe she should go speak to someone and see what's happening with her. And so I think that was a really interesting thing because I would say that I had already sort of been suffering in many ways previous to that, but in a very sort of quiet or way where you have a veneer that you put on where it doesn't maybe ostensibly seem like it. So when I went to see those first few psychologists, that was kind of like my first real experience starting to explore what was happening in my mind. And at the time I was self-harming and yeah, I had really poor body image. And so I ended up seeing a psychologist. I'd seen two that were kind of not that good. And so, you know, kind of did that thing where you kept trying to find the right person to speak to. And so I ended up having this conversation with someone at the local hospital in the town I grew up in. And that was a sort of hour-long conversation, after which I was told that I was a danger to myself and needed to be admitted. So it kind of, the unveiling of my mental health journey was very much this sort of 0 to 60 kind of thing. And I think for my parents as well, where there hadn't really been any acknowledgement or noticing that there was something happening internally for me. And then all of a sudden it was like, whoa, Lily's just been admitted. And that's kind of when things really kicked off.
Yes, that sounds really sudden. And so at that time you said that it hadn't really been acknowledged. So did your parents know that you were self-harming and you were going through things, and it was that they just didn't talk about it?
I think at that point, it was just very much that sort of beginning phase of it. Not phase, that's not the right term, but it was just the beginning. And so it was just these different coping mechanisms I was exploring. So I don't actually know whether they knew or not previously. I think because they were both really suffering themselves in their relationship breakdown, that it probably wasn't like an intentional, like, ooh, we're just going to ignore Lily, but perhaps just being a bit wrapped up in what was happening for them personally. And so, in fact, it wasn't until after I got out of the psychiatric ward that I probably started to self-harm a lot more, and then struggled with disordered eating. And it was kind of after this initial point of like, whoa, really sudden treatment, that things kind of actually spiraled a bit more, which is almost ironic because you'd think, oh, actually she went to get treated, maybe that would have been helpful. But I think just timing wise it was a bit it came at an interesting point.
For sure, that makes a lot of sense. I want to come back to that, but first I wanted to ask you, in terms of you going to the psychologist and being sectioned, being told that you were harm to yourself, at the time did you feel that you were harm to yourself? Was that news to you, or was that something you were aware of?
Yeah, I don't think I felt that way about myself at all. In fact, it was quite a dissociative experience, I think, going to the psychiatric ward, because it was so random in my eyes. And to be fair, I guess another part of that conversation I'd had was with that initial psychologist was that I had contemplated dying. So there was that element of suicidal ideation, which I think is what made them so much more kind of keen to do something really quickly. But I certainly didn't feel as though that was appropriate for me. And then the act of then being there and witnessing all these young people who were really, some people in really, really difficult places and spaces in their head and just their lives, and kind of feeling like, what is happening? Why am I here? So that was interesting.
Yeah. And so to come back to what you said about in many ways being worse when you came out than when you came in, I think from what I know about it, that's not an entirely uncommon experience, particularly when, like yourself, it's been quite a shock to you. It's all been very sudden. And then you're around all these people that you see as being so much worse than you. You know, it's a bit of a rude awakening to, oh, this is how bad you can get.
I think so. And then I think the idea that to be kind of sequestered away from society, to be told that there's something unequivocally wrong with you and you need to be somehow held far away from the rest of the quote unquote normal people. I think that for your own concept of self, particularly at a time 13, is a really formative and seminal time in your own adolescence. You're already confused about what it means to be growing and developing, and then to have someone say to you, actually, you're a bit fucked up, really. You kind of then think, oh my gosh, I must be, because that's what I'm being told. And recognizing sometimes when you're inpatient, that the biggest support systems actually end up being the other patients themselves, as opposed to the treatment that you're receiving. Because for me, it was just like immediately being medicated and then not actually really doing that much therapeutic work as such. I guess in their context, from the sort of maybe more clinical view, it was about stabilizing me. But in that, it was kind of each other that we had to rely on. And I think because you want to normalize your experience, you kind of all kind of come together to be like, actually, wait, maybe we're all okay, and we can be there to support each other.
Well, there's a sort of camaraderie ship in it, because it's such a unique experience that they're going to be able to relate to what you're going through in a way that no one else, including potentially the, you know, the people at work somewhere like that, can relate to. And so you said then that you came out of that experience and you were worse off. Could you talk us through what happened then?
So yeah, I think after being released, it was one of those things where it was so sudden when it did happen that I sort of spent this week away where no one really knew where I was. And then I think that almost that self-stigma of being so ashamed and confused about how to articulate where I'd been and what I'd just been through, I think that kind of really weighed quite heavily on me. And then, of course, needing to go ahead and navigate the complexities of high school and of being a teenager. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think things definitely got quite a bit worse for me, in the sense that I feel like being so explicitly labeled almost gave me something to aspire to. And I use that phrase a bit facetiously, but it was almost like, okay, you're going to put this box in me, like I'll touch all the corners and like really sort of see what that's like. And it's not that it was sort of an intentional or conscious thing as such, but I think because obviously like a lot of my own support system with my family and with my friends, like people weren't really certain of how to help me. And I think a lot of times, particularly with using medication, there are normally things that are happening beneath that. And I hadn't yet found a way to start exploring my internal experience in a way that was healthy. And so for me, I think feeling really overwhelmed with the intensity of my emotions, of being quite sensitive and very open people to what the experiences of others around me are. And so not knowing how to navigate that and then starting to cope in just really unhealthy ways. I think with self-harming, a lot of times people just conceptualize that as, you know, cutting, but I think there are other ways that we harm ourselves, whether it's putting ourselves in really dangerous situations. It can be lots of sort of like drug taking and going about and hanging out with all sorts of weird and wacky people and doing weird and wacky things.
It's interesting what you said there about once you had the label, you felt the need to explore all the corners, even if it was unconscious. It sounds a little bit like, you know, this thing was kind of put on you unexpectedly, this label of mental illness, and then in a way to take ownership of it. You said, oh, I have this, I might as well explore it to the max now.
I think, and like there's something actually by virtue of the label itself, that you kind of almost feel bound by it in a certain way. Though I'm sure every person experiences it differently, because I know some people where it's quite helpful because you kind of know what you're dealing with. But I think in my personal experience, because it was such a formative time in my life, it really almost changed my own concept of health and really impacted my identity. And so in many ways, a lot of the work I've had to do moving forward has been almost unraveling some of those things and kind of discovering who I was previous to that and learning how to take my diagnosis and my experience and not let them sort of consume all of my lived experience, which obviously extends far beyond the life that I've lived extends beyond having a mental illness.
And the diagnosis you had was major depressive disorder, is that right?
Yeah. And then there's a bit of sort of questioning and uncertainty about parts of my diagnoses and experiences. Because I was a minor being treated in the US, I had very little agency of what was happening to me. I wasn't necessarily always like fully informed. I ended up on like 220 milligrams of Effexor, which is a mood stabilizer, which might lead one to believe that there was some sort of bipolar thing happening. And I remember like discussing hypomania with my psychiatrist, but then I actually really don't know whether that, what that amounted to. So there's a bit of almost like a question and uncertainty about that. And I've tried to get records, but I haven't been able to yet. So it'll be interesting to see one day.
I think particularly so many people we speak to on the podcast, their first diagnosis is anxiety or depression or both. And often they end up being re-diagnosed with something else, but often those can be almost like place markers, like we're still figuring it out, but you have many of these symptoms, so you can have this one for now. Whereas, and I think generally nowadays people understand anxiety and depression, even in a loose way, what that means. Whereas you get a condition that, you know, isn't just depression, it's, you know, major depression disorder. And as a young person, it must be so difficult to understand what that is, particularly when, as you say, there wasn't a huge amount of information and support always given to you.
Yeah, and I suppose that there is something to what you were saying with that, that iterative nature of working with your mental health and that. So it is almost a sort of casting about in the dark in many ways. I think we have this concept of science and medicine that it's so precise and exact, but it's actually just as much guesswork.
And so at that point, so that's you at sort of 13, 14 years old. What came next with you and your mental health journey?
So I carried on living my life as I was with my various coping mechanisms, being really heavily medicated. And at a certain point when I was coming up to graduating from high school, which was 17 years old for me, I just got to a point where I realized I wasn't feeling anything. You know, I was putting myself, I think, because of the way that meds can sometimes interact with your body, like it was such a sort of numbing or flatlining. Like I think in the beginning it was important to have control over the intensity of what I was feeling to a certain extent. But then as time progressed, it then just became this sort of flat plane that I was looking out across, which was my life. For whatever reason, I still don't know why. I just kind of woke up one day and was like, you know, I need to get on meds. So I went to my psychiatrist and I was sort of like, okay, this is what I'd like to do. And he was like, oh, I don't recommend it. Like, just, you know, 50% of people who get off, you know, relapse and have to go back on.
I think that percentage is really interesting because as an optimist, I'd be like, 50%, that's fine. That's good odds.
Right. Yeah, exactly. For him, that seemed to be like, whoa, don't do it. And that was a really crazy process because it, like, it truly has, like, this withdrawal, like, my body being so confused about what was going on, even though I was going down 25 milligrams by 20 milligrams in, like, you know, 2 or 3 months. But that was a really important part in my journey, because then I think that actually marked the beginning of my recovery journey more so, which might sound a bit odd because you think, no, that probably started after you were admitted. But I think for me, that's when I really then started to feel good. And I think that was the process of really learning about myself and learning about how I interacted with the world and what things were healthy for me and what things weren't. And so that kind of really began truly an experiencing of it, which I think allowed me to start really healing.
That's great to hear. It's a thing I'm glad you've brought up on the podcast, actually, because there seems to be this sort of divide with people who are experiencing mental illness, whereby there's like one group of people that need the meds and that they need them long term, and that is the best thing for them. And then there's the other group of people that it really is just something finite, that they need them for a certain period of time, whether it's what they're going through at the moment, whether it's whilst they're getting other support to drill down into the root issues, whatever the reasoning is, then they are best coming off it. And for many people, it's obvious, but there is a sort of like middle ground where there's some people where it's quite unclear almost which box they fall into. And it's only really by, you know, speaking to medical professionals and sort of trying it out that you can really find out.
Definitely, definitely. Yeah, I think with the treatment of anything, particularly mental health, for me, I always kind of conceptualize it as it being on a spectrum, which I know is not a particularly unique idea. But within that, you know, what works for one person doesn't necessarily work for another. And even what works for one individual at one time doesn't necessarily work at another time. And so it's an idea of experimenting and playing and really trying to find some of their own intuition within this clinical space of trying things out. Because I think that's not to say that I've never wanted again. If I felt that it was right at another time in my life, that I would, if it was going to help. Universal solution that will work, and it just doesn't happen that way.
Yeah, if only there really were happy pills, wouldn't that be fun?
But I feel like the nature of our sort of biology and our neurochemistry, it's like, no, everything's so situational. There's so much about context that plays in things. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess, yeah, in a, I don't know if I want to take a happy pill.
That's the thing. I mean, if they did exist, everyone would be on them, and then we'd all be equally happy. And
what
then people would
be with anyone.
Well, that's it. That would just be normal, and people would want to be ecstatic, not happy.
That or miserable, because who knows?
I don't know. So that's where you are leaving high school. What happened then in terms of you going to university? Did that change much in terms of your recovery? What was that experience like?
So it was very interesting because the town and the environment that I grew up in put a lot of focus and pressure on college or university. And in the US, you might be familiar that it's a very weird and interesting system.
And expensive. You know,
hugely expensive. There's a lot of these sort of classical associations of like fraternity, sorority kind of culture. Mm-hmm. And I think just where I was at in life, that just so did not appeal to me at all. I really couldn't wrap my head around that. And so I ended up taking 2 years out before heading to university. And then when I was applying for university, which I did my senior year as many other young people do, I really was so detached from it. I applied to one university, that was the University of Edinburgh, and then I got in and I deferred it for 2 years, so my acceptance. And so, yeah, I think that was partially me also, again, coming back to that intuition of, like, I'd just gotten off meds, and I think in myself I didn't feel ready to go. And then still facing a lot of that societal pressure of that being something that was quite looked down upon, because in the United States people don't really take gap years as much. It's not as common as it is in Europe. And so there were a lot of people that were sort of like, ooh, well, are you ever gonna go? Like, what's wrong? What are you doing? It's just sort of like, man, I don't care. I'm not doing it.
So at that point, it's completely understandable to me that you took the time out, because you'd gone through, you know, this big change of weaning yourself off the medication. And that's something that in one form or other you'd been on for years since you were about 13. So it makes a lot of sense that you needed to kind of adjust again to life without the medication. And also moving to Edinburgh is a massive change as well. I mean, Edinburgh's pretty different to where I live in Birmingham, and at least we're still within the UK.
Yeah.
And so what was it like, that experience going to university here?
So it was amazing. I mean, I think upon reflection, sort of in hindsight, I came to recognize that in many ways, coming across the Atlantic Ocean was a very much an act of running away. I think, yeah, I kind of always had this kind of drive to get out and to see more things and to put myself in new situations and challenge myself. And the fact I could rely on myself and I was taking care of myself, and then starting to uncover a lot of sort of passions that I had held and maybe lost or hadn't given enough energy to for whatever reason along my journey, that I kind of was able to reclaim.
Sure, that's really cool. And so at that point, you're one of, by the sounds of it, one of the rare people that actually did go abroad and find themselves. I generally think of that as a bit of a myth, but you're clearly the example. And so one thing that interests me about that is you were becoming a lot more comfortable with who you are and getting to understand yourself better. But at that point, even in uni, you weren't really talking about your experiences of mental illness. Is that right?
Yeah, definitely not in the beginning. And I guess I'd like to come back to that idea of like finding yourself thing. I wouldn't say that it was the act of leaving that allowed me to find myself, and because I think like it is kind of a misnomer. It's, you know, you can go anywhere in the world and you'll still be your same you. Mm. It just so happened that for me, changing my environment allowed me to carry on that journey of discovering myself. So it's still in process. I can't say I'm completely found. So.
Still searching.
Yeah, still searching. Always will be. But, you know, I've made some progress. But yeah, when I first came to university, yeah, the focus was on meeting people and going and doing fun different things and studying at times. And so, yeah, it wasn't being like, hey, I spent time in a psych ward. That's what I told people.
So with this episode being all about speaking up about mental health, I'm interested to know, was that something you were sort of consciously holding back that information? Obviously, as you say, you're not going to really use it as an opener when meeting someone new, but was it something you think you consciously were holding back from mentioning when you got to know people better?
There were some friends that I had that I then started to feel more able to speak about these things with, but it just, yeah, it wasn't something that I was really jumping into. It was, you know, I had to really feel like I had a connection with someone, and it had to just kind of more be coming up organically in order to sort of acknowledge it. But by virtue of the society we live in, that it didn't have to come up if I didn't want it to.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And that being said, though, when you were at uni, you did stand up and talk about mental illness in a really public way. Could you talk us through that?
Surely, yes, I did. I did indeed. In my second year of university, I was at the Society's Fair, and there was a stand for TEDx University of Edinburgh. And I was, oh, hey, cool, I love TED. I want to do a talk with TED, because I remember when I first heard about them when I was 15 or something, you know, one of those memories of being like, oh, what would I be able to speak about if I had that platform? So I got involved, and they
that's
had this
on
sort
my
of
bucket list. I think about that all the time.
Right?
Yeah.
It's such a good thing. You're like, come on. But then when you're actually given that space, you're like, hold up, wait, now I need to say something of substance and meaning. No, that's the challenging part. So they had this student speaker process that you'd go through. And at the time I was working for this student-led social enterprise called Freshsight, which was a business consultancy. And so I really thought I was going to be speaking about the third sector, but we had some of these sort of exercises we were doing, and I kind of started to recognize that's not where my expertise was, simply because I had only been doing it for about a year. And then as I started to reflect on the things that drove me, which were around sort of connecting to people and listening and hearing about what makes people tick, I think that's when I recognized that the story I had to share was more about my own mental health experience. And so then I kind of went through this process of being like, okay, negotiating how that would be for me to really speak candidly about that. And I ended up going ahead and doing it. And so I gave this talk to an audience of about 500 people. And that was pretty much the first time I spoke very frankly about my mental health. And then obviously it was recorded and put onto the interwebs. So it exists there. And yeah, it was really a surreal experience, and the process of crafting that speech was very difficult, just personally, about going back to those spaces and thinking about what and how I wanted to say it. But then the end product was really, really beautiful and powerful to have done.
That makes a lot of sense. There's something I experienced with the podcast, particularly we did an episode a few weeks ago that I mentioned to you off air, with Jenny Pusey, who's also lives in Edinburgh. We did an episode with her all about student mental health. And for the intro of that, I knew that I really had to talk in depth about my experience at university, because that was when my mental health was at the very worst. And I remember feeling a lot of pressure when it came to recording that to get it right, because often people that don't know what that experience was like for me don't initially get it, that I was at my worst when I was at uni, something that, like in America, in this country, is very much held up as pinnacle achievement of education, and such a privilege and a brilliant life experience for so many. And yet it was really a horrific time for me, and I felt a lot of pressure to really get that story right so that people really would understand it. So can relate to that, wanting to reword things. And in the end, I ended up putting the recording out virtually as it was, because you could, even if I didn't have said all the relevant things I wanted to say, you could hear the emotion and people really connect to that. And so for you, once you'd figured all that out and you'd done the speech and it had gone online and everything, how did that change how you felt talking about mental health?
I think in one way, it really clarified in me how important of an experience this was in my life and that it's something that I needed to be speaking about more. And I think to take a platform so public and to speak about something that's important to you on it, it really made me feel like, actually, wait, I need to be doing more of this. So I think obviously it helped because in so many little ways, it encouraged me to start those conversations. Just even when I was writing the speech, like going to flat parties or whatever and having basic banter, and then someone asks, oh, what are you up to? And you say, I'm going to be giving a talk with TEDx. Of course, the first thing they ask is, oh, about what? And so in so many little ways, I had to be like, oh, my mental health. And then normally a conversation would ensue after that. And so I think I was most struck by the fact that people were super chill with me mentioning this fact. And then, if anything, they were actually really excited to have a space to reciprocate and to speak about it themselves. So I'm not sure if you've experienced that, but if you kind of say, oh, you know, I run a mental health podcast, then it's almost like people suddenly have this permission to divulge all of their thoughts about mental health to you, whether it's their lived experience or the experience of their friends or family. And so I think that's when I really got this sense of the fact that, I mean, as we all know, we don't speak about it enough. And so, and the fact that when you do actually have more honesty around it, that it's not this horrific thing that people want to ostracize you for, but actually a point of connection, because it's quite a part of being human, I think, of having a brain and having mental health. So, it made me want to do that more.
Yeah, and that's right, that's a very similar experience to I have. And I think that's why fair and realistic representation of mental health in, you know, in the media, like film, TV, news, is so important, because there's so many people I know that haven't had any discrimination, haven't really experienced the bite of stigma, and yet still don't feel they can talk up about these things. Even to, you know, someone like me, I never had a problem talking about mental health or mental illness with people. However, there's been plenty of people in my own life who I'm really close with, yet they didn't talk to me about things that now, having started a podcast like this, they do talk to me about. And that's really weird, because I never thought I was projecting any kind of, no, you can't talk to me about that. But sometimes that's what it takes, is you standing up and demonstrating that it is okay. And then suddenly people flock to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, because I think as well with stigma, there's something wider. There's self-stigma. And then there's the messages that society gives to us that are internalized, because we can't go through our lives not being impacted by the messages we hear from media, from family, or even, you know, obviously now we have social media and we can hear so many different voices. And I mean that, you know, just as like the kind of common going rhetoric. And so, yeah, you can't really avoid it. So sometimes it's sometimes in yourself that you're like, I actually can't speak about this because of all the things that I've seen and heard, it should not be right to talk about. And so, yeah, by taking that first step, to start the conversation and to lead with your personal experiences, then that can give people the permission to flock.
Yeah, I love that, the permission to flock. So we are coming near the end of our time now. So I'd like to round up with how you're taking advantage of that and how you've turned that into your own organization to tell stories about mental health.
Yeah, so I think I left the experience of giving the TEDx talk with this clarity that we needed more space to speak openly about mental health experiences. And I didn't really know what that was going to look like, but I kind of sat on this idea and let it percolate for a year. And then what I kind of thought I wanted to do was to support people who wanted to learn how to tell their story with the tools to do so. So that was kind of the storytelling tools, and then run a community event where they could share to an audience so that we could really have a safe space to speak. And so that's where the idea for Real Talk was born, which is the mental health storytelling organization I run. And what that looks like is I collaborated with a professional storyteller, and we designed these two workshops that participants go through that teach them the storytelling skills, and they craft the story based on a lived experience. And then I host a community event, and all the audience come in, listen to the stories, and then I have question prompts out on the table so that there's actually facilitated conversation that happens after we hear the stories, and then an informal question and answer so that the speakers and the audience can really have this dynamic interaction with each other. And it's been such an incredible thing, because I started doing that very much as a sort of like one-off passion project. I just thought, oh, it'd be really cool to try. And I got 6 people on board who went through the workshop, shared their stories. We had the event, and it just went so incredibly well. Everyone that showed up really wanted to be empathetic. They really wanted to listen, and they wanted to know more about each other and about their lives. And so that was in 2016. I ran that first Real Talk session, and I've been doing it ever since. It's been 2 years now, and I think I've run about 14 events to date. So that's seen over 50 people go through the process and learn how to share their story, and over 500 different audience members come along and join the conversation. And yeah, it's been really incredible to see our shared humanity, and to see how at certain points in their, you know, in your recovery journey, how powerful it can be to own your story, to have agency over how you want to tell it, and then to have that witnessed. And I think in having someone witness you, you realize that your story can help others, because when you start to share, people learn about maybe their own experience and learn about the experience of their loved ones. And we can start to kind of brainstorm on how to help each other out.
I don't really think the power of speaking up can be underestimated, because as you say, it can really not only start conversations but give people additional insight. A big part of me coming to terms with having an eating disorder was realizing that at a certain point I was relating to other people's experiences too much for it to be normal. You know, I understood the mind of someone going through that too well for it to just be coincidence. And that was a part of getting help with that and coming to terms with something that I was hiding from everyone, including myself. And it's incredible, having a podcast like this, how often people reach out and say how much it helps them just hearing these stories. You know, and I'm not a medical professional, only some of our guests are, but, you know, it's still having that change. And I know that people have gone and sought help off the back of listening about to these conversations and being like, oh, they've experienced that and they're doing well now, so maybe I can too.
Mm.
And so if people want to learn a bit more about Real Talk, where should they go?
So they can visit our website, which is realtalkproject.org. And then we have Facebook, which is Real Talk Storytelling. And our Twitter is at Real Talk Stories. And yeah, you can engage with us mostly through those mediums. And we're actually just trying to make a wee podcast ourselves, where we're going to actually audio capture the stories that happen on the evening and then bring those speakers in to interview them about that process of story crafting. But that's still in its primordial stages. So that will be a while.
Very exciting.
Woo! Yeah.
Grand. Well, thank you so much for sharing your experience today. It's been great to hear.
Thanks. Thanks for having me and letting me share it.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta,
with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.